Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everybody here from Chicago. Welcome to today's podcast. In today's segment, we will be talking with Mr. James Fair. He is a senior VP of Tech Ops at a leading MSP known as Executech. They're based out of South Jordan, Utah. James, thanks for your time. Let's go get started soon.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate the invite. I'm looking forward to this.
Well, thanks. Well, we did some background snooping on you. We didn't do like a background check or anything, but you seem to have a very deep and rich background in cyber and security as well. Can you tell us some of the highlights of your career and kind of like how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Thanks for asking. So I started out as an entry-level tech, and I worked my way up to running a department. I don't know if we have time for a story or not, but I had a previous manager we had a previous manager. It was the three of us. He was leading two of us. He was kind of one of those, I don't know, I don't want to be mean, but really a dictator and just totally overbearing to the point where we were afraid to touch equipment unless he was there. And it was like not fun. Like I remember standing at some equipment that I knew was down and no one, and we were all afraid to reboot it because of him. And, anyway, one day it was near Christmas time, and he wanted a raise and didn't get it. So he got pretty demanding, and he told the company leaders, he said, "All right, I'm gonna go on vacation for 2 weeks, and I'm gonna come back in 2 weeks, and you better give me my raise, and I'm gonna show you how much you need me." So for 2 weeks, my cohort in crime and I, we just went crazy and tried to fix everything. We threw away some equipment that wasn't failing. We replaced some equipment that we needed to replace. We just went nuts for 2 weeks trying to fix everything, and we worked, nearly around the clock, 6 days a week or more. And at the end of those 2 weeks, he came back and said, "All right, you guys ready to hire me back?" And they said, "You know what? You can just go ahead and stay gone." And and at that point, it was just the two of us running the show there for a while for a film company here in Salt Lake City. And I saw the writing on the wall. I knew that eventually it couldn't be the two of us, so I started kind of being the point man. I made sure that I was on top of everything. I took care of things. I was the first one to respond to calls. And about 6 months later, the COO came to me and he said, "All right, we're going to offer you the position. Would you like to run this show?" And I said, "Absolutely." So that was my first management stint. And that company grew to about 1,000 end users. And I was there for about 20 years all in. Then I did a stint, and I was over everything. First it was IT, then of course, cybersecurity was a facet of that. Then they started to run on things like database and physical security, and just kept throwing things at me as I was being successful, apparently. I decided my next gig would be a director, so I was a director for a place that was another lesson for me, an opportunity for learning opportunity. And then I joined Executech here about 9 years ago, almost exactly 9 years ago, last month. And
excellent.
Yeah, thank you. And here I started again as a tech again. I did the IT director position. I thought, man, I never want to be a director again. It was just a miserable place to work. My wife was like, "I don't think it was the job. I think it was the place." And she was right. One of the things that drew me to Executech was it had been rated the best place to work in Utah several years in a row. And that drew me to the company. It was a very people-focused company. For the first time, I was working for a place that really genuinely cared about people. Very hands-off approach, so like no micromanagement. In fact, my first client, the founder of the company, is no longer with us, but he and I went to this medical company. It was my first client, and we met with them. I got my list of like stuff they wanted me to work on, some long-term goals and some pain points, and we walked out afterward, and I said, "Okay, do you want to report when I get done with some of this stuff today?" He said, "No." And I was like, and I came from a place where I was micromanaged to death, right? So I was like, "Oh, maybe like a weekly progress report then." And he said, "No." And I was like, "Well, I'm kind of getting snippy at this point. I'm like, do you want any kind of report at all?" He goes, "Not really. Unless the client gets angry, then let me know." Now, we're a little more hands-on than we used to be back then. We've got a customer support team who monitors our clients to make sure things are going well. But that's still the approach we want to take. We very much have a treat people like professionals and they'll act like professionals in a trust-based, people-focused type environment. And I've since it was a place where it was led the way I wanted to lead. It was, a place where I could thrive And I did. I made team lead in 6 months. I made VP in a year and a half, and senior vice president a couple of years ago. So,
congratulations. Well, is this a company that you've actually helped? Is this a company you've actually helped create, maybe, or had any part in its when it was first formed, or you were just hired straight as a direct employee?
No, it was about 20 employees when I first started. It was started by one man out of his garage. He was driving around his broken down old pickup truck. In fact, he didn't have a heater in it, so he was driving around with one of those portable gas heaters in it, which is probably terrible.
Wow.
You know, nowadays it would be a health risk for sure, a health hazard. But one man driving around trying to make do built this into a multi-million dollar company.
Wow, excellent. Now, how long has ExecTech been in business?
Since 1999. So we are on our 23rd year.
Oh, congratulations. Now,
thank you.
Do you have a presence in other countries as well, or do you stay local to Utah and, like, the states surrounding that, or are you, like, on the
so
East
far
Coast
we,
or other places?
Yeah, great question. We are not on the East Coast. We have focused primarily in the West. One of our focuses has been to be one of the largest MSPs in the western half of the United States. And we're definitely one of the largest presences here. So we do have offices in Seattle and Spokane and Sacramento. We've got a location in Phoenix. We actually have three divisions here in Utah. So we've kind of split the state up into several areas, about 50 technicians across the Utah region. We've got some folks down in southern Utah. We've got a couple guys in Colorado, a team in Colorado now, actually. A group in Texas. So the West, certainly, that's been our focus. Anything, kind of Texas or western Mississippi, we'll say.
Okay. Well, one question I want to ask you is the MSP business. Now, I've got some other relationships with other MSPs. Is it as competitive as they say it is? It's really, really, like, ultra-competitive. What are your thoughts on that?
As far as being an employee or
just
in the space itself?
The space itself, I mean, given the geopolitical climate today and MSPs now being on the responsible now for it, like another solar winds attack doesn't happen, how is it?
I would say, it's a fairly competitive market. On the plus side, we have kind of positioned ourselves a little differently. One of the ways we did that early on, pre-pandemic certainly, was that we offered an on-site consultant. So someone would come to your business, and we primarily targeted small to medium businesses. So these were companies that need IT support but can't afford a full-time IT person. They would contract with us to come in and be the full IT department. And then we will assign technicians or consultants to that business. So rather than calling and getting some random person on the phone, you're calling up James or Robbie or somebody that you know, someone who's familiar with their environment. I've had a couple of clients where I knew all of them. They all knew me. I knew some of their spouses. We frequently get invited to company Christmas parties because we really become part of their team. We're immersed in their culture, in their environment. We get to know everybody, and we run everything. One day maybe crawling underneath a desk, plugging in a cable. Next day we're working on, switches and routers. Next day it's server information. And some days we're sitting in C-level executive meetings helping the company decide what would be best for them to go as far as technology goes. So we do it all. But we separate ourselves with a very, that individual unique approach was a big facet for us. We also offer, even though you have one person who's kind of the point man or woman for ExecuTech, we have a team behind them. That's a big part of what we do. Every person out there needs to feel supported and that they have, guidance and they have people they can fall back on. Because IT is so broad and so wide, there is no way everybody can know everything about it. And we don't pretend to. We don't pretend any of our individual people can do that. But we've got 150 other consultants that they can refer to, and chances are pretty good someone on the team knows what has the information they need to be successful for their clients. So we kind of let ourselves stand out that way. Yeah.
Okay, so that kind of gives you your competitive edge then. Okay, cool. Now, who is your typical customer base? Are you trying to target the SMBs, the Fortune 500, the government sectors or perhaps a mix of all of them? Or what's your sweet spot?
Our sweet spot, I would say, is definitely small to medium businesses and smaller government. We take care of a lot of cities and towns, smaller cities and towns, certainly. Now, we do backstop for some larger clients. We have one in northern Utah where we have four or five consultants there at any one time. So we'll provide some backstop for clients. We'll provide a large IT group for an entire department if necessary. But in general, our sweet spot is probably 30 to 50 users. Again, folks that, you know, don't necessarily want to bring on a full-time IT person, or if they do, they only have one IT person to rely on, whereas they can hire us and have an entire team of people, you know, some 150 consultants across a diverse, you know, rich background of different IT knowledge.
So are you like an exclusive service, or do you also do like staff augmentation as well, too, for these SMBs?
We're not a temp agency in that regard. We're not going to provide, you know, resources for other people, but we absolutely have gone in and provided, you know, some teams may lack the experience in certain areas. For example, there's a lot of movement to the cloud these days, right? So a lot of IT teams internally may not have that knowledge. So they'll bring us in to guide them to a migration into the cloud, perhaps give them some training, and then sometimes keep us on to be able to provide ongoing support for the high-level stuff that they need. There was a big city here in a suburb of Salt Lake that hired us to come in and do their 365 migration for them. They were unfamiliar with it. They were kind of, you know, some of the cities are kind of still back in the times a bit with their technology, as these folks were. And they knew they needed to move to 365. They hired us. We brought in 30 people, I think it was, one day, to be able to help them complete that migration, train the users, you know, get them over that hurdle, and then let their internal team manage it from that point on after we train them.
Okay, excellent. Well, I'm at your website right now, so let's do a deeper dive into your product and service lines. It seems like you have services like managed IT, cyber, and the cloud. Can you expand on those in more detail? And if you have other service offerings and products, can you talk about those too as well?
Sure. And those three are our primary pillars of success. So that's really what we're after. So, you know, IT is the world we came from. We offer a managed service approach, a managed IT approach. And we do have a traditional team that we brought on that will do the, you know, a service desk type approach for clients. Most of our clients nowadays, we do a hybrid approach where we have a service desk that they can call on for any needs. And then anything on site, we'll, you know, we have a, what we call a senior engineer, and we'll give them so many hours per month to be able to go into those things that they can't be handled remotely. So IT is definitely our core. That's one of our primary, you know, how we came to be. We've also spun up a cybersecurity team, and that's been evolved where we have an offering now, and you know, a full suite of offerings. Well, one of our products we call is TDP, Threat Detection and Prevention. So we will bring in a team of cybersecurity experts as well as some hardware and some services. We'll layer those things on top of the existing infrastructure for whatever the company is using in order to provide that peace of mind and, you know, several layers of, because security is all about multiple layers to try to prevent the attackers from getting through it. So we'll come in with a team who can help set up, you know, some more secure email, spam prevention, a firewall with firewall monitoring, some anti-ransomware products, you know, and this entire suite of products that we'll bring on that we refer to as TDP. And there's several packages that we can offer, but that's the primary offering for the cybersecurity team. And then we have a cloud team. So that's a big portion of what we do, and it's a huge growing industry for us and for everyone out there as people move to the cloud. You know, traditional server rooms we're seeing kind of going away. That's not to say they don't exist. They certainly do. But more and more, we're seeing folks who don't want to have to worry about a server that they have to replace every so often and hope that they can scale it to their needs, and that it has to have, you know, redundant power, and what if the internet goes down, and you know, there's concerns about fire and flood and theft, and cloud has really been a way to move away from that. Now, it's an ongoing monthly cost, which some shy away from, but it also offers huge scalability, right? If you decide to double your staff tomorrow, a couple clicks, and we can double the size of your server infrastructure in the cloud very easily. Mm-hmm. It offers redundancy because it's managed by Microsoft, for example, the Azure Microsoft Cloud. It's managed by massive organizations across multiple regions. If one region goes down because there's a natural disaster, things are automatically moved over. And in most cases, it's pretty seamless. No one knows it actually happened. Host machines can come up and go down, but again, it's all seamless. So we're seeing a big migration away from the typical traditional server room and into the cloud. So that offering has scaled tremendously for us. That's a big part of what we do as well. So, yeah, and I can offer success stories that we've had along those, if that's of interest. But
yeah, please go ahead.
Those are our three core ones. Sure.
Yeah,
so, sorry, let me cut you off. Go ahead.
No. Yeah, go ahead. Well, one question I want to ask you before we go into that, James, I'm a customer of Azure also. I've got a CSP out in Oregon that I use. Now, Microsoft are announcing some drastic price changes, or actually uptick in prices, I believe starting in the next week for the M365 base. Have you dealt with that yet with your clients, or how have you dealt with them? Has there been pushback, or what's the reception been like?
Generally, it's been good. People accept that there's, and we can demonstrate there's been no price hikes for quite a while, and these things are an eventuality. And companies like Microsoft, they kind of get to dictate those things, and we all kind of have to follow along. In some cases, we can leverage, like perhaps we move to an annual billing instead of a monthly billing in order to compensate for some of those costs. And in a lot of cases, when you bring in a consulting firm, we're going to look at the way you have things set up and perhaps offer ways to do what you're trying to do with less money. For instance, I've taken over several clients where I go in, and the first thing I do is I scan through their email accounts, and I'll find three or four or five accounts that are no longer being used that they're paying licenses for every month. So, how long have they been paying for those licenses? Well, I just paid for them to have several more licenses or bring on some other products instead with that same monthly charge being removed. So while there are certainly, increases and they're a pretty regular, occurrence in our world, we can also do things, in a more audited and therefore typically less expensive fashion.
Okay. Have you had clients or customers that want to go to like the AWS Amazon Web Services, and if so, do you help migrate to that, or just exclusively all Azure?
No, we're not exclusive. In fact, we're probably not exclusive really to anybody. We deal in all technologies. That's one of the offerings that we have is that we understand that not every business is the same, so we offer very different solutions for every business. Some of our competitors, you come on board and everyone gets the same hardware, the same setup, and we're not that way at all. We know that every business is different, so we tailor every solution different. So some folks prefer Microsoft, some folks prefer Google, some are Mac, some are Windows, and we're gonna adapt to that environment regardless of what they use. So, yeah, if folks are interested in AWS, and we certainly have some clients that are leveraging that, that's an option. Microsoft and Azure is our bread and butter. It's what we, will default to. It's what we're most familiar with. But that isn't to say we don't have expertise and can offer other solutions. We absolutely want a primary offer. We typically have a primary offering and then a fallback offering if that primary one is not what they're looking for.
Excellent. Now, tell us your success stories. This is going to be interesting.
Yeah, so I can actually name a couple names here. I typically don't, but there's a company called Cassell. And if you're not familiar with Cassell, they have been around since like 1978, and they're a software that helps local communities run cities. They've been around for a long time. This is what they do. They're very popular in the small cities and environments. Their entire software is designed just to help you run a city and do it very well. It's a very impressive product that's been growing. However, they were running into some challenges, and they came to us because they'd heard of us and we were started partnering together. They were on like a Zimbra-hosted email server. Their email address or their IP address for that email server would sometimes get blacklisted, so there was no way to start emailing people. They had trouble with collaboration internally. They didn't have remote access to files. So we came in and we helped them migrate to an Office 365 environment so that everyone, first of all, the mail started flowing properly as it should have been. Office 365 groups were created, so we can help with communication. We move their assets into the cloud so they have access to OneDrive or SharePoint. Calendars, right? Calendaring works much better when everyone's in the same environment like that. And then the remote teams were able to communicate using Teams, or back then, you know, it was Skype. So we actually helped them reduce costs by 15% during the migration. This is an instance where we've been able to save money, even though the expense may seem like it would be more. Yeah, in actuality, we ended up saving them about 50% costs overall. We moved them to almost a zero downtime environment using 365 for those folks. So that was an example of a successful cloud migration. And we have since helped them spin up a solution into the cloud. So now they now have a Cassell cloud offering, which can then, just like any other cloud environment, can scale based on the needs of their clients and the number of clients that they get at any one time. I'll tell you about a case of some ransomware. That's pretty common these days. Unfortunately, it's still, you know, a big thing everyone's on the lookout for. I can't name the name of this client, but it was an auto company. It was a big dealership. They sold trucks throughout the Intermountain West out here. They had like a dozen locations across a bunch of like four states out here. It was a huge company. They'd won Dealer of the Year a couple times. And like by 2018, they were up to like 300 employees. So big company. And unfortunately, they got hit with ransomware. And it you know, crippled them. They had no access to their files. So the CFO had heard of us, and he called us up and was interested in seeing what we could offer. So we came in and we did an assessment for them, and they said, yeah, let's make it happen. So we moved them also to Microsoft 365. We put in some new firewalls for them. These were, you know, advanced firewalls with what we call deep packet inspection and network filtering. So it's doing, like, I don't get too technical here, but botnet blocking and these kind of things. We threw in anti-ransomware product that we love and we've tried and true, is tested for us. And one of the things they didn't have backups. Their backups were not up to par, which they discovered, unfortunately, once the ransomware had hit. So we helped them configure, you know, good backups with good security. And actually, right after the presentation, they got hit with ransomware again. And that's when they said, all right, we're pulling the trigger on this one. Let's make this happen. It was costing them too much money anyway. So we came in and we did one of the advantages we have is we can bring in a whole team of people, a large team. So like within 24 hours, we had touched 320 end devices across their entire 14 locations, just a total overhaul and upgrade within a whole day. And one of the great quotes I got from the CFO, which I really appreciate, was, as CFO is one of the largest dealer groups in the nation, I realized that the weakest element of our executive management team was our knowledge of technology and the ongoing need for managed security. Now that we have engaged ExecuTech, I can sleep at night knowing we are in good hands. And we hear that a lot. We hear that pretty frequently. Yeah, it's a great feedback to know that we're helping people, you know, sleep at night. And that's not the first company. I've worked with a large, what we call a tractor sales company here in Salt Lake City. And the CFO said almost the exact same words to me. He goes, you know, with you guys here, I feel like I can sleep at night again instead of being up worried about these things that you know, not everyone can wear all these multiple hats at the same time. And ransomware, it's a big deal. So those were a couple examples of places where we've done really well and, you know, help companies do that. There are a couple others I could share, but if you have other questions, I'm happy to move on.
Sure. Sure, share them, please.
Okay. Let's see. We'll call this one. This is a fuel delivery company. They did lubricants across the southwestern U.S. And it was founded over like 50 years ago. So big company, like some 230 employees. And for about 10 years, they'd employed. And I don't want to beat up on the small organizations. We certainly were one at one time. But they'd engage a local managed IT service provider to handle their needs. And I believe they'd outgrown what that company was capable of providing to them. So they got hit with ransomware, right? There's an attack on the network. Oh, it was a phishing email campaign is where it came from. And they didn't have any kind of spam prevention in there or any way to deal with that. So we came in, we did a penetration test. We, you know, found where the weaknesses were, where the holes were. We set up a simulated phishing campaign. So this can feel a little big brother for some folks, but it's much rather that we give them, you know, that we start phishing them and find out who's going to click on the links and then properly train them rather than having it done by an attacker and having the outcome be horrible. So it's much better to have a team come in and simulate that. And we've got some guys who get pretty creative about this stuff. They'll formulate these email messages and craft them specifically to the company based on their usage. And in some cases, really attempt to get the users to click on things. And it's not to beat anybody up. It's really to bring awareness that this is a real attack vector. And people, you know, nowadays attackers are realizing that it's tough to break through the firewalls and the antivirus and the anti-this. And it's much easier to go after the poor, busy people who are, you know, digging through their 300th email at 6 p.m. and just want to go home. Those are the weakest links oftentimes. So those are become the attack vectors these days. So we do want to create these simulated phishing campaigns where we attempt to do what the attackers are doing. We raise awareness. We do some training with those folks. And it works. I mean, I will, in every case where we've done this, as the IT company, we'll see a big uptick in people reaching out saying, hey, is this a real email? Is this okay? Should I have clicked on this? Like, oh, I clicked on this stuff. And people ask me, is it okay for me to send you these things? And I say, I would much rather receive 10,000 of those than let a single one get through that was real and have you be in a position, you know, an ugly position. And we did a network scan. So we'll come in and we'll do a full scan of all the files and all the environment of the environment. And in this case, we found something like 30,000 social security numbers and 3,000 credit cards. We'll do a dark web scan where a third party that we use that buys the same password list that the attackers are purchasing out there in the dark web. And then we'll run checks against email addresses or domains to see if there's anything that shows up. In this case, like 13 of their email addresses had been breached in the past. They had their logins and passwords for those. So something like, yeah, if you look at the compliance regulations, it could have been somewhere in the range of $15 million that they would have been paying should that have gone through and been successful. But because we implemented these things, we stopped those from happening. They were much more secure, and still they're a much more secure company because of that. And again, I got here's an owner quote. The local IT services provider that we previously used did the best they could, but given our company's growth, we call it flexible fuels. Flexible fuels would be out of business today if we had not moved to ExecuTech. So we love to hear, you know, wow, stuff like that from our clients. That's great stuff.
Excellent. Okay. Now, as we move on to the second half of the show here, I'd like to get into some cyber issues here that kind of get your thoughts on. The term artificial intelligence is one that's being so overused right now. It's one of those things that everybody, you know, every vendor tries to put in their product and they try to push it out of clients and people get all excited. You know, hey, I've got AI on my security, you know, suite here, you know. And I mean, I've written a book about it. I mean, I can't say I'm an expert, but, you know, there's really nothing, I guess, extraordinary about it. I mean, all this is garbage in, garbage out using some statistical algorithms, you know. I know we're trying to mimic the human brain. In fact, my dad was a professor at Purdue and involved in neural transplantation, doing the same kind of work, actually. So I'm kind of familiar with that. But long story short, what are your thoughts on AI? I mean, does ExecuTech make use of it? And do you think it's an overused term? It's just a bunch of technical jargon. What are your thoughts on all that?
That's a great question. I mean, I would defer to you as the expert, but I'll provide some feedback from my perspective. So there are cases where we will leverage it. Our security products do indeed have some learning algorithms in there. For instance, we'll talk about the anti-ransomware product. So if you think about traditional antivirus, it's, you know, person A got hit with something. We take that signature and we send it out to everybody else so that nobody else gets hit by it. But in an anti-ransomware product, rather than doing that, what it's looking for is it's behavioral-based. So it watches for instance, files getting encrypted. Now, if it sees a few files get encrypted, it goes, well, that's weird behavior. You know, I'll keep an eye on that. Then suddenly it's 50 files getting encrypted, and it goes, wait a minute. This is probably not what, you know, something. This is probably something malicious. And it stops the process that's encrypting those files. So rather than being reactive and signature-based and someone having to get hit by it before the rest of us can respond to it. Now it's responding to behaviors that we see, and it's been, in our cases, we've seen it be extremely effective. It's a great product, and it will work with other variants because it's not looking for signatures, it's looking for behaviors. So unless the behaviors themselves can be masked, there's a very effective way to prevent attacks, or to at least, you can't clean it necessarily, but it will stop that process cold, and then it will alert somebody, and we can go in and figure out what's going on and try to, you know, clean it up at that point. So there are certainly cases where that's an advantage. For instance, 24/7 monitoring, we partner with a SOC, Security Operations Center, and they use AI so that every single packet that could be tagged as malicious isn't having to be reviewed by a person. Rather, they create, and you know, you're right, it's an algorithm. It's rules and rules and regulations and processes in there that say, hey, something's up, let's send this to a human to review. So in those cases, yeah, it's more of a process or procedure or a rule set. But there is the concept of it learning from things, right? We see an attack morph. Perhaps we can start learning from those opportunities. And I think most of us have seen the Google AI where it calls and makes an appointment for you and those kind of things. So this is becoming, you know, a bigger industry. And if we think of something like, I just drew a blank on the name. They used AI for the election campaigns, where they were sending fake news, so people would get people with a certain
deep fake news.
Say again.
Deep fakes, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Is that the term?
There was a company that was using AI, and I listened to this. Pardon?
No, go ahead.
Okay, sorry, Robbie. It'll come to me in a minute. I'm just drawing a blank on the name right now. I want to say cybernetics, but that's not it. Something dynamics. Anyway, they were using AI as learning because they'd watch the behavior of users online on social media and then create news that was created. It wasn't real news, but create news that would then interest those people to think a certain different way, right? So they start creating this news and go, yeah, you're right. Look at this. I have to look at the name of that company. But, you know, in that case, they are using artificial intelligence to persuade people in a way that, unfortunately, was a little scary. It had originally been used for good, and I listened to a podcast by the inventor. He was the one that kind of wrote the program initially, and it had been meant to help people. But over time, he saw that people were kind of, I don't know, weaponizing this tool in order to, fund campaigns, or whoever wanted to pay for this then could use it for their own advantages. So there is some scary stuff happening in the AI world because it can be used in social media to provide, you know, ways to kind of manipulate people, especially people who are prone to that kind of a thing. But in general, on the tech side, I like the aspect where it is at least helping us in the security realm to adapt to the ever-changing landscape. Because attackers get smarter, you know, it's this mouse and mousetrap thing. We better build a better mousetrap, and the mice get smarter and start figuring out different ways to do it, and this goes on and on. So it is still in its infancy, I think, but I do worry about what that can look like as computing power scales, as the intelligence behind those scales, you know, what else could happen if that stuff like that can happen.
Right. I think one fear in that regard is what they call deep fakes, where they can kind of like take an image of someone and create like a fake video. You know what I'm talking about?
Of course.
Yeah, that's another big fear that people have right now too. So I don't know. Anyway, well, the next topic here is the Internet of Things. I'm an old-fashioned kind of guy. I still drive an 03 Honda Civic, all analog instrumentation. And to be honest, I hate technology. I don't have any mobile apps or anything. My financial advisor, he's got a smart car. He can clap his hands, the damn thing rolls out. You know, it's kind of like a James Bond kind of thing. I think a guy who loves that car that comes out of the water, you know. But I'm not into the Internet of Things. I think it's scary. There's too many, you know, rooms for failure. I don't have a smart home or anything like that. Do you have anything like that, or what are your thoughts about it?
Yeah, I'm a techno nerd, so I love all that stuff, man. I can tell Alexa to turn off, and she was talking, to turn off my front room lights when I'm in the bedroom. And I've got it set up to where I've got some under-the-counter lights that I installed, and I put up a motion sensor, so when I walk in the kitchen at night, it turns my under-the-counter lights on so I can see. I don't have to, my hands don't have to do anything. But it's too bright, so after 10 p.m., it goes to half brightness. So, yeah, oh, I love leveraging in technology like that. It's a big part of what I do. I've got cameras around my house, and if it detects motion, and you know something pops up on my screen, if my garage door is left open for 10 minutes at night or half an hour during the day, it alerts me because that's happened before. We left our garage door open all night long, had stuff stolen from it. So I'm big on leveraging that thing, but there's certainly some downsides to it, as you mentioned. Every single one of those devices is created by a human, and they're probably all different brands, and we're gonna, you know, from all different countries. And who's to say that that company who created that is going to be top-notch on their security, that there are no flaws and no vulnerabilities, or that if you don't keep updating it, some aren't going to show up later. It happens all the time where we install a product, later that product's not updated because, you know, an exploit's found later and a new version is released. But are we all up to speed on every single device that we have out there? Our smart light bulbs, for instance, my kitchen will turn red. I don't know why I wanted to, but it could if I wanted it to. You know, are we updating the firmware on all these things that are smart devices? And the answer is clearly no. So we are, in fact, creating security holes, very likely, in our environment. Now, there are ways, certainly for people like me who are technologically inclined, to deal with that. I set up a separate guest network wireless in my house, and all of my devices that are smart attached to my guest network. I do not put them on my internal wireless network. So I keep them separate from them because, yeah, absolutely. Who's to say that my smart vacuum, which my wife bought, not me, who's to say that Cambridge Analytica, sorry, just came to me. Who's to say that those devices aren't going to have an exploit later on that someone could drive by and not necessarily attack me with a vacuum, not worried about that, but be able to break into my network and then into other devices and use that as an attack launch from that point. There have been plenty of security cameras in the past who exploits have been found, vulnerabilities have been found, and there are searches you can do right now on Google to find security cameras that are available on the Internet with still the default login and password set up. So you can go see people's cameras, and not that I want to, but that's, you know, an example of where the Internet of Things can be used against you or can be a security violation or a security hole for you. So I do recommend a couple things. Put it on a separate network. And if you're not, you know, if you're not savvy enough to do that, bring in someone who can, or maybe you don't go down that road. Maybe that's not for you just yet. And then please, please, always, always, always go in, log into the device and change the default login and password to something that's not default, because the defaults are widely published and widely known.
That's one thing that people don't do. They don't change that once they get the product. They assume it's going to work. You know, but anyway, well, the next other one I want to ask you is about COVID and the remote workforce. Now, you know, back 2 years ago when we were first hearing about, you know, this coming out of Wuhan and China, nobody ever realized it would grip the world like it has today. You know, and some, you know, obviously a lot of bad things to come, some good things to come, but probably one of the, I guess, better things that came out was the remote workforce, you know, the 99% remote workforce. People thought that this would happen maybe 4 or 5 years from now, but we saw it happen in 3 months. Do you guys work remotely? How has COVID affected you, especially like with this new strain that came out from, I believe, South Africa? Was it the Omicron variant?
Yeah, that's a really good question. That's something that's impacted all of us. In some ways, it was beneficial to us because we had more business. Business increased suddenly for us, where some industries were hit by this pretty hard. The IT industry actually tended to increase because the demand suddenly went up. So early on, what we saw was a huge increase in requests for setting people up to work from home. So, you know, everyone needs a VPN license, and if you want to know what VPN is, you can go into that. But everyone wanted a secure connection from their house to their office. So suddenly we had a need to be able to deploy people and this huge uptick in requests for laptops so we could send people home. That was and then figuring out ways to secure that home environment because, you know, your children may get on that same computer that you're now using to connect to the corporate network. So trying to figure out ways to keep that more secure. And certainly the space has taken its time, but we're starting to see more and more products come out to address that need. As far as ExecuTech goes itself, primarily we were not in the office very often. Most of our consultants would go from their house in their company car to the next client, the next client, the next client, back to home. So we didn't congregate much in the office. Now, every Friday we'd get together for an early morning training. That was a big part of what we did. And, yeah, that kind of decreased to the point where now it's all virtual. We just meet online instead. The in-office staff, the accounting firm, the sales folks, the CSM team, those folks, they had originally been completely in the office, and they switched to a work-from-home environment. They meet once a week in the office, for instance. In fact, our corporate office is going to move. We're going to get a smaller location because we just don't need the space that we were using because we're not there nearly as often. And we're seeing a pretty similar trend in most of our clients. Now, there are the whole gambit. Some clients are like, nope, we're work from home. Forget it. We're not going back to the office anymore. There's no need. Everyone's going to be work from home. And we see a lot of workforce who, you know, different opinions, but the majority of workforce seems to like that. There's no commute anymore. They can get up from their desk and go and get some lunch. They can, you know, have more interaction with their family throughout the day. So there are certainly some advantages to that. But there are still many of our clients who can't function that way or choose not to function that way. They want to be in the office. They're like, no, we collaborate well together, and when we all go home, there's no collaboration. Or, you know, we're a manufacturing facility, and we have to have hands-on through, you know, the assembly line and things that are here. But in general, we've seen, I would say, somewhere like probably 30 to 40% of our clients come back into the office space, while still many of them are doing a work from home or a hybrid. Probably more and more we're seeing a hybrid solution where, okay, you can work from home 2 days a week, but we're in the office 3 days a week or vice versa, things like that.
Okay.
That's your question?
The next one I want to... Yeah. So, do you think this 99% remote workforce is not going to be a permanent footing in the American society? Do you think we'll ever go back to the office, or it's not pretty much the way it's going to be?
I'm pretty sure this is here to stay. And again, it depends on your environment. Not everyone can do that, right? Grocery stores certainly can't do that. Restaurants can't do that. But in the technical space and then office environment, things like that, I suspect a lot of folks are like, yeah, you know, at first it was tough. A lot of people were like, I don't want to sit here and look at another Zoom screen yet again. I think you mentioned you weren't a huge fan of Zoom or Teams or these other technologies where we're doing a video environment. They're like, I don't want to stare at my screen all day long and be stuck in my chair all day long. And there's certainly some truth to that. The flip side are people having to juggle children at home or children being schooled at home, right? So I won't necessarily offer my own personal opinion, but overall there's definitely pros and cons to both. I do see a trend where fewer and fewer environments are going back to the office or going back to the office fully. The people that can work from home tend to do so more than usual.
Right. Okay. Well, the next question is going to ask you, the next hot button topic is that of cybersecurity insurance. I also, my last book was on, like, calculating risk of insurance, how to select insurance policy. It's still a very murky area, and I think it's even worse than trying to choose medical insurance. For example, an SMB owner may think, oh, I've got cybersecurity insurance. I'm all, you know, anything can happen to me now, I don't care. But that's not the case. If they file a claim, they may not get the whole payout. And I know that the insurance companies are putting down a clamp that they're not going to pay, for example, they're not going to reimburse you if you make a ransom payment. Have you had clients ask you about cybersecurity insurance? Do you offer anything like that, or do you help broker? Do you like work with the broker and the client, or how do you work with that?
Yeah, so this is an interesting space, and I've been attending some webinars put on about this. A couple things. We do not offer cybersecurity insurance, but we do recommend it. It's just the ransomware is so prevalent these days, and most companies couldn't afford to cough up the amount, you know, required by the ransom demands in some cases to do that. Or in the case, for instance, the University of Utah here in Salt Lake, they were hit with ransomware. They did everything right. They had the right backups. They stopped it. But they paid not because of the ransom or the files, but because data had been exfiltrated. And this was student data, private information. They didn't want it to get out to the public, so they ended up paying to avoid that exfiltration of data. And that's what we're seeing a lot of these days. And not only are they going in and encrypting all your files, they're stealing a bunch of those files and then threatening to go public with that information should you not pay. So, but what we're also seeing is a huge uptick in the cost of cyber insurance. Now, originally, I think these cyber insurance companies were like, yeah, let's go. This sounds like a great, you know, revenue source for us. Let's go out there and do that. Then as companies started getting hit with ransomware for these huge charges, I think they started to see that, whoa, this is a landscape we had no idea how bad it was going to be. The cost of cyber insurance has gone up like 300% in the last just, I think, year and a half or 2 years. So we're seeing a huge uptick. And now some of these cyber insurance companies are saying, okay, we will insure you, but you need to have these things in place and you need to have these security measures in place. But it's still such a new field, and most, you know, insurance companies aren't necessarily technical companies, so they're having to play in spaces they're not familiar with. How do you check up on that? How do you make sure they do that? You just write a policy that says, well, you didn't comply, so tough, we're not going to pay you. Now, they're traditionally, cyber insurance, that's what it's for. It covers payments should you need to lump sum to these attackers. Unfortunately, I certainly don't want this to happen. I wish we could stop paying them. If we stopped paying this, it would stop going on. It wasn't, you know, income right. for these folks. They'd stop doing it. But for now, some people are just in a place where they have no choice. If all the company files are under, you know, being held hostage, then they have no choice but to end up paying. So, yeah, cyber insurance is a real thing. It's also scaling like crazy in the cost, and I'm not sure how long it's going to continue in this fashion. I'm also interested to see how much influence are cybersecurity or cyber insurance companies going to have over the infrastructure that they are now insuring. You know, as I mentioned before, okay, we'll insure you, but you're going to have to do X, Y, and Z or set up these 20 things. And, you know, is it 10 now? Is it 200 in the future? You know, where does this end? And we're also seeing some, at least here in Utah, and I'm sure in other areas, some legal changes being made by the Congress and these local government entities, the state entities here in Utah, for instance, are looking at passing some bills related to cybersecurity, because they want to be able to protect their businesses. So, for instance, one of the rules I saw was that our potential be a bill was, if you have put certain measures in place, then perhaps you don't pay nearly as much of a fine than as the company who didn't put up those things to try to prevent it from happening. So I think that's where we're going to start seeing more action. Not necessarily, I think we'll see the government start to step up and fill in the gap where the cyber insurance isn't right now. So it's still very much in flux. As I mentioned, we're seeing a huge uptick in the cost of cyber insurance. And I expect to see that trend continue. I think they underestimated just what they were getting themselves into when they first started down this path.
Right. Okay, finally, data privacy laws like the GDPR, CCPA, CMMC, do you help your clients come into compliance with these legislations? Or that's not kind of in your area? Or how have you helped your clients to have about this?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a big part of what we do. We deal with a lot of DoD contractors, government entities who need to be compliant. You know, as you mentioned, CMMC. Not a lot of GDPR, but certainly some of our clients have business overseas or in Europe, in which case we'll help them do those. So, yeah, we absolutely. The biggest ones we see internally are HIPAA. You know, the doctor's offices, dentist offices, patient data, that kind of thing. People want to be HIPAA compliant. And overall, what we see is PCI compliance. This is, in order to be able to take credit cards, you need to be PCI compliant. that's probably the biggest industry we see, because most everyone wants to be able to take client, credit cards in order to facilitate ease of pay from their customers. I'll tell you a quick funny story, then I'll move on with the question. I had a client, it was a law firm downtown here in Salt Lake, they're still my client, and they came to me one year and they said, okay, we want to be PCI compliant, what do we need to do? And they only took credit cards like two or three times a month, just a couple customers would pay them once a month. And I started going through the list of things that they needed to implement in order to be PCI compliant, and after just a few minutes, the owner of the company, he just said, you know what, forget it. And he called up the clerk and he said, would you please tell our three customers that we take credit cards from, we will no longer take credit cards from them. And to this day, they still do not take credit cards, and they do not have to be PCI compliant. They solved that problem very quickly. Unfortunately, that's not the case for most, most folks out there want to be able to take credit card information, take credit cards in order to facilitate an ease of payment for their customers. So PCI compliance is a big deal, and that's one of the primary ones I think we probably focus on the most. But we'll absolutely help folks get there. We may involve the cybersecurity team, depending on the severity of it. PCI we can help with, but when it gets, things like documenting and setting up some more advanced things like that, dealing with, I'm drawing a blank. Anyway, sorry, CMMC and some of the other compliance. Oh, NIST. This is the NIST 800 rules. We got a cybersecurity team. That's what they do. They're experts at this, and we will absolutely help clients move that to, in that direction. And we won't just kind of, like, for a lot of companies, they'll look at what it takes to take that on. Like, oh, we want to be compliant. They look at it and they go, oh, my gosh, are you kidding me? I have no idea where even to begin with this mess. So one of the things that we like to offer is a path to get there. It's not here you got to fork out, crazy amounts of capital up front in order to get there. It's let's put something together that makes sense for you and for your business and for your budget, where we're gradually getting there, so that down the road you're absolutely, you're on target to get there. So we'll provide a path, a roadmap, if you will, to become compliant rather than trying to do it all at once, which most places attempt to do.
Right. Oh, wow, that's a good differentiating the thing right there. Good. Now, the CMMC, do you see a lot of that or somewhat or?
Somewhat, not a great deal. It's not one of the most popular ones we deal with, certainly. But again, we deal with, cities, towns. We deal with DOD contractors, that kind of a thing. So I think what we see most, we're seeing a lot of NIST 800 come up. That's a big one. But, DOD has to be CMMC compliant. So, yeah, we're seeing DOD contractors coming to us saying, we want help getting compliant. How do we get there?
Yeah, well, the whole thing's such a big mess right now. I think they've come out with the CMMC 2.0 to make it more affordable and more streamlined, but I think the whole thing's still a big mess. Anyway.
It is, and it doesn't seem to settle on any one of them, right? There's like all these different ones. Which one are we going to choose? Which one's the most? CMMC and NIST seem to be kind of leading the forefront out there. But we don't know which one's going to win out in the long run for sure.
It'll probably take 20 years for all that to get figured out. But anyway, as we start to wrap up our show, so what do you think the cyber threat landscape is going to look like? I mean, it's definitely changing, with the political concerns out, with the Ukraine, Russia. What do you think it's going to look like? Is it going to be more of the same like last year, or it's going to be different, or what kind of new threat emergence do you see on your radar?
Yeah, that's a great question. Unfortunately, I don't see a lot of change happening yet. I was very excited to see the Windows 11 release. I started reading all about it. And not to beat up Microsoft, but I didn't see anything in there about dealing with ransomware, right? There was nothing about, here's how we're going to deal with ransomware, which was, I thought, kind of a letdown because this is prevalent and it's a big deal and it's a big problem. And this it continues to grow in scope and size because other criminal organizations getting behind this, realizing there's money in it. So I have to imagine that there's some future where this thing doesn't exist. We've been through similar things, but I don't see that happening anytime soon. I don't see that happening in 2022 where we suddenly abolish all challenges of ransomware. And it's my belief, my personal belief at least, that the reason for that is many companies aren't disclosing what's happened. They want to keep it quiet so their customers aren't alerted that they may not be, they may not be as secure as they thought they were. And because we're not being open and honest about what's going on, we're not being very collaborative about it. If everybody that got hit all at once started collaborating across the entire world, you know, and I realize there's a political landscape here we have to play in, but when we start seeing cross-border, cross-border assistance and working together, that's when we can really start nailing these ransomware attackers. But as long as, you know, a ransomware group can stay in a nation and just promise not to attack that nation and then they let them stay there, then this is going to continue to be a problem. And we're starting to see, more government involvement in this. The problem is the government also isn't necessarily a technical organization, isn't necessarily designed to deal with this. This is a fairly new threat. So it's how do we, do we force companies to admit the fact they've been hit? Do we force companies to do security? What's the impact of that? This is a tough landscape. It's a tightrope to walk. But at the same time, we can't keep doing what we're doing. It's not working. We're funding bad guys, and we continue to fund them, and so they just get bigger and bigger and smarter, and we're starting to see pipeline attacks and attacks on infrastructure and this kind of thing. So, it's a real concern, and I hope that we get smarter about this, but I don't know when that will be. Unfortunately, don't think it's going to be in 2022, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, here's an interesting thought for you. You know, like after 9/11, I think George Bush, he created the Department of Homeland Security to kind of centralize all. What if we, a Department of Cybersecurity was created, kind of centralized all, cybersecurity efforts and initiatives? Because every state's coming up with a version, for example, of, their own data privacy law. It's causing confusion. You go across one state, you have to abide by this, blah, blah, blah. What do you think about creating like a Department of Homeland Cybersecurity or whatever you want to call it? But it's where it functions like the DHS.
Yeah, I think it's going to be required. It's not going to get better until we have some collaboration, some involvement from the top level, because businesses aren't working together to solve this. So we're going to need government involvement to do so. And I would love to see something like that. The question then becomes, do they strong arm people? What rules, regulations, is there going to be an enforcement coming from that? But regardless, we've got to do something different. What we're doing is not working. So I would love to see more government involvement from the top to say, we got to do something about this. We have to stop this. Let's all work together to find some common grounds and common solutions. It's not going to get better until we do.
Yeah. One last question that's going to be completely different is Windows 11. I hate Windows 10 with a passion. I mean, I hate it, and I've made a promise to myself the next laptop I buy is going to be an iOS system. Windows 10, it just blows. But I've read a couple of articles for clients on why you should not upgrade to Windows 11 right away, and I'm not seeing a huge rush on people upgrading to Windows 11. Have your clients made that shift yet, or have you advised them to, or what are your thoughts on this movement to the new platform?
To date, we held off because Windows 11 kind of came out pretty quickly, and I'm going to just say my personal belief here. It was really tough for vendors to catch up, right? Before we throw out a whole new operating system, or at least an upgrade to an operating system, we want to make sure that our antivirus supports it, that our anti-ransomware is familiar with it, right? That the security holes, at least the majority of them, have been found and hopefully plugged with patches. So we're typically not early adopters, at least as far as our clients go. We want to make sure our clients stay safe and secure. Now, Windows 11 was included in a Windows update, so suddenly you clicked and bam, you had Windows 11. I got a buzz to go with it. My wife, she said, I'm on Windows 11. I'm like, what? Because if you didn't go in and say, no, thank you, it would automatically upgrade you to Windows 11. So that certainly was the case for a while. I think we're going to make some changes here internally, but I don't want to speak for the company yet. I believe we're now at the point where it's probably safe to do so. Enough of the vendors have gotten there. It's been out long enough that most of the security, at least the glaring holes, have been found and filled. It's never going to be flawless, but neither is Windows 10, neither was Windows XP. They all have vulnerabilities in them, which is why Microsoft continues to roll out patches and updates, most of them which are security updates. I think we're now at a point where it's no worse than any other previous operating system. So I'd say it's safe to upgrade at this point. Okay. And eventually you're going to have to, right? They're going to turn off Windows 7. They're going to turn, you know, Windows 7's already at end of life. Windows 10 will be one day soon as well. So they make sure you kind of have to in some regards. I think it's safe to do so at this point.
Okay. Well, I'm going to wait. One time I left, they tried to force my laptop, and I'm saying no way. But I'm just fearful one day I'm going to turn my laptop on. They're just going to say, oh, here's an upgrade. It's going to go to Windows 11. Finally, as we wrap up our show now, what's the best way for someone to get a hold of you? Should they just email you, phone you, or what's the best way?
So we set up a website for doing podcasts like this. So executech.com/cast, C-A-S-T. Get you some information. You can reach out to me from there. I'm happy to answer any questions people have about security or operating systems or ransomware, whatever I can do. My job is to be of service and assistance to those out there, just as yours is. So, yeah, executech.com/cast would be where I'd recommend that they go.
Well, James, thanks for your time. I think it's a great podcast. You can definitely shed some insight and some things I never knew about. But we hope to have you again on a future show, hopefully.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate the invite. It's been a pleasure. And, yeah, look forward to doing this again sometime. It'll be a lot of fun. Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, thanks for your time.
Take care, guys. Yeah.